You are listening to TechWatch Radio for May 31st, 2014, episode 388. Sam Bushman, Jay Harrison, live on your radio, talking tech as always, our website, techwatchradio.com. Welcome to the broadcast, sir.
Hey, Sam, how's it going?
Absolutely marvelous, my friend. This week in tech has kind of been a strange week, though. I'll tell you what, it's amazing how many tech things we depend on and deal with. There was a power plant that blew up in Illinois. It had two sides, I guess a couple of million people depending on it for power. And it had a steam pressure explosion. Very strange. And there wasn't much about it in the news. The interesting thing is they're all talking about the environment and talking about how we got to get rid of coal power plants and everything else. And it's interesting. Not much was said about that blow up. Did you hear about that, Jay?
Not really. No.
All right. So anyway, that's kind of an interesting thing to start out the broadcast with and just kind of mention. USA Prepares has a news piece on it, and it's very weird when power plants blow up and there's not a lot of news coverage about it. And exactly how it blew and the details are being investigated now. They claim the second unit will be online soon, but it's probably going to take a whole lot longer than they think it will. That's number one. Number two, a lot of people are saying, well, wouldn't those 2 million people be without power, Sam? And the answer is, without the complex power grid that we have, they most certainly would be without power. But you know, we have a very complex electric grid in the United States, and you know, when it works great, no one really realizes, but it's a complicated thing to patch, you know, power back and forth all over the country, and I think that we ought to create a better plan. I don't think that the checks and balances are very good there. In their defense, though, you know what, the average Joe, even in Illinois, has not noticed not having that power plant going down. So to some degree, the grid's working, right?
It's a lot like technology, though. Technology, there's so many things built on everything, all the way up from binary through the OS to the internet and all the interconnects. It is an amazingly complicated thing, so much so that not one person even can be an expert on all of it. And the power grid is very similar. I mean, there's so many complications. When it all works right, we're oblivious, and it's just kind of transparent to us, and everything's awesome. But it doesn't take a lot to mess it up. And thankfully, with this power station going down, and thankfully it wasn't nuclear or something when it had a steam blowout there, Illinois, everybody else, the other junctions kicked in, and the power grid worked as it should, and people didn't even realize, like you said.
Yeah, to make it a simple statement, you know, what happens when you put a stick in the spokes, huh?
Exactly. It could have been a lot worse. And I think that's why a lot of people haven't really paid much attention to it. I mean, sure, it's been in the news, it's been on headlines. And like myself, though, I haven't read a ton about it because it was just like a small blip on the radar. Hey, we had a problem, but everything worked like it should. So yeah, I'm sure they'll get it fixed in due time.
Yeah, what's fascinating to me, though, is that it didn't hit main news. Like usually when something like that occurs, you would think it hit main news. But there's just so many things to talk about these days. What do they call this thing, Nemenja? Jay?
Well, you know, I don't really know. I think it's Nemenja, yeah.
Nemenja.
It's a POS
like
malware.
Spokes in the wheels technology-wise, right?
Yeah, especially if you're running an e-commerce or a regular commerce system, you know. This POS, which stands for point of sale, malware has compromised 1,500 devices and 500,000 payment cards worldwide. What's interesting mostly about this story from this Nemenja POS malware is that it, even in articles on different places that I've seen, is that these articles are the first to prove that incidents of new hires, people that are coming in, they're calling them mules in the nefarious tech industry. They pay somebody to get hired at a Subway or a Target or whatever, and they're entry level people, but those people are getting jobs specifically to install malware into the POS systems on existing businesses. And the takeaway from that I see immediately is this is exactly why install level privileges, like admin privileges, should not be available to the average employee in a business. I mean, a lot of businesses just run their computers in admin mode because they're used to doing this from XP and Windows 98 and everything else, where you can do whatever you want. You're like super user when you're logged in, and they can just stick a thumb drive in and install whatever they want in there, malware or, you know, their own software, or they can be on Facebook and get, you know, some kind of virus. And so this is why you want to be running in a very limited user mode, especially on your POS systems. And people just, they've got to improve. They've got to consult with IT people or have some way to make sure that this isn't happening. And that, you know, when you're bringing in somebody brand new, that trust has to be earned. And just, this is kind of a shout out to businesses, small businesses, large businesses. Don't just trust the people off the street. There is now proven, and I've been saying that this has been happening for a while, but this is backing it up. There are people being planted as mules to install malware in POS because it's such a lucrative way to get card
and what's interesting
payment card
to me,
information.
Jay, is we used to have POS systems that were like hardened OSs that were like unique to the device, and they were much harder to do what you're talking about to them. Now what they have is they have a full-blown iPad or a full-blown PC with a POS piece of software application or some kind of a transactional application for credit cards just running in the clear. And so I guess what I'm saying is that move to more full-fledged systems has decreased the cost of implementation quite a bit, but it's also opened us up to nothing but trouble.
That's very true, and it's a two-edged sword because the using off-the-shelf consumer hardware makes it very cheap to install a POS system, but it also opens you up to a lot of vulnerabilities because when you're using the most widely used operating system out there, instead of something that was built your own where somebody'd have to know custom, you know, API calls and everything else to interface with it, you open yourself up to a large surface area, attack surface, where anybody can just install their own homebrew Java app or whatever on your system and hack it.
And I guess these mules that are going in and getting these low-entry jobs, they're kind of getting paid on the back end a bigger chunk of change. Whether they'll be caught at this or not depends really on how good they are.
That's right, because it's hard to prove in a lot of places, especially retail, you know, you think Starbucks or whatever. Sometimes they have a lot of turnaround, and how can you even, you know, even if you can get to the right time frame and say, oh, we see that this was installed between this date and this date, you know, you might have had three employees that came and went since then, and how do you know which one did it?
Well, and then the other real most important question is, even if an employee did it, now you got to prove that they intentionally did it, right? Because it's one thing to say, you know, I was on Facebook chat with my girlfriend and I shouldn't have been, but I didn't intentionally put some kind of a malware or destructive ware or on your system. Come on. And so now you got to go to the next level, too, because it's one thing to have an accident happen. It's another thing to prove some kind of a hostile intent or a violent breaching of a server for financial gain. That's a whole different discussion.
You're exactly right, because you would have to – they could be like, oh, I was just looking at some photos I had on a thumb drive. I didn't know it was in fake. You'd have to not only prove that they did it and that they had malicious intent, but you'd also have to probably track the back-end money where they got paid off as well in order to make an open and shut case against them.
And that's 9 times out of 10 going to be on a completely different system, a completely different – and like I say, the more sophisticated it becomes, the harder it is. To solve. And I guess I wouldn't really spend time on trying to catch who it is. I think you're right. I'd spend my time trying to make sure it doesn't happen in the first place.
Close the doors. You know, and a lot of times people aren't even being paid by real cash. There are so many things that people will barter for. I've seen on different gaming sites and stuff where people sell their accounts for iTunes cards. You know, it's like, hey, give me a $100 iTunes card and you can have my account and I'll sell it for that. So people, it'd be very hard to track a payoff to somebody else, especially if you get barter involved or other things. And like you said, and I agree, it's, you got to close the holes and focus on that. You're not going to be able to, I shouldn't say not, but it'd be very hard to track somebody down and form that whole case.
Well, and most of these mules, it reminds me of Script Kiddies, Jay, where they don't really even know what they're doing. All they know is if you follow these 10 steps, something happens, and you get money or you get whatever you want, and girlfriends, drugs, games, free things, whatever you're getting somewhere. So it almost becomes kind of like Silk Road or whatever they call that thing where, you know, you can almost do anything you want to on the internet these days, and the real tracking is going to be very difficult. Number one, I would focus on hardening of systems. But number two, I would like to say this, though. The bigger the business, the bigger the city, the more likely this is to happen. In other words, Jay, if you ran a little computer business and you had, you know what, four employees and you knew all of them, and then one new employee came that you didn't know, I mean, it's pretty easy to start narrowing stuff down. It would be a lot harder to get that done. Whereas if you're in a Starbucks in, say, New York or Chicago or something like that, where there's just literally dozens of people, nobody knows anybody, you know, then this stuff is very likely to occur. And it just, in my mind, really brings home the idea of, you know what, in America, we should be entrepreneurs. Big business, not so savory. You know, small hometown businesses where you know people, and that's a whole lot more of the, I don't know, sustainable go-forward plan in my mind. Now, I know if you're in a big city, you're going to say, Sam, that's not even possible. But I'm just telling you, this stuff is likely to happen in the bigger cities. Just because you run a company, I wouldn't melt down thinking you're in trouble. I would hire a security expert to try to, you know, make sure there's no holes in your deal and that you're appropriately running in the right limited user modes, that you've patched your software, that you've disabled, you know, different ports that could be the easy way. You know, I think that you ought to take the time and do your due diligence. I also don't think it's time for small business to panic necessarily, Jay.
You know, I see what you're saying about that, the small business versus the big business. But I think actually it may be that small businesses are more vulnerable to this. Yes, they in the smaller towns, they might have not have the same people that you'd have a large variety of people that can come and go. You might know them a little better. But the smaller businesses are the ones that are going to be more apt to use an off-the-shelf system, not secure it properly. Whereas if you have a big chain, like think Target or something, they've got plenty of hardened IT guys. Their systems have been, you know, tried and true in so many different areas. They're going to be a lot harder to gain access to. And, you know, maybe they won't be, especially if there's some unknown hack or something like that, you know, zero-day exploit that somebody's using. But in the smaller businesses, you're more likely to just, you know, they have one login for the cash register, for example, and everybody just uses it, and it's the admin account and whatever. And that's the kind of stuff that you see, and I think that they are the ones that most need to pay attention to that.
Well, and that's why I say that they have less of a vulnerability from people or hired mules. They have a greater chance due to lax security and lack of knowledge and the likelihood of just kind of do-it-yourselfer mode. And that's why I kind of said at the end, I suggest hiring an expert. I wouldn't panic, but I would find somebody to help you make sure those holes aren't there. You're less of a threat from people and more of a threat from laxed systems, unintentional, so to speak, than you are from an intentional breach that the bigger cities might be. Anyway, I bring that all up because I think understanding your threat is the greatest way for solutions. And for the big city, it's people bringing them in, and like the mules you're talking about, whether it's intentional or otherwise. On the small business scale, though, it's more of a you can't have a single login and say, I'm not going to have an IT expert or a security expert, I'll do it myself. Not so fast. You need to step back and say, I want to make sure that my systems are as secure as they can be. It's not as much my people that I'm worried about, but it is the systems. It is the laxed way of, hey, I you know, I own a business for whatever I do, a tire shop or whatever, and I'm just going to do my own IT stuff. I know I'm not very good at it, but it's expensive and I don't want to mess with it. Those days are over is my point. And focusing on what the differences are in the threats, in my opinion, is key to solution.
Indeed. And unfortunately, that's true. You got to have some help in these things.
Because I've had a lot of contractor
guys.
Everybody
has their expertise.
I've had a lot of contractor guys. You know, I've bid jobs for them, and I'm like, you know what, for this much money a month or whatever, I'll be on retainer and help you with this and this. And a lot of businesses have said, nah, I'll just do it myself. Later, they kind of call me up with some regrets a lot of times. But all I'm telling you is that's kind of the mode of small business guys to where, you know, they're doing very well in their business, but they feel like they can cut a corner here or there. And I'm not telling you this because I'm asking to be hired, but I am telling you this from an IT perspective and a security perspective. That ain't the place to save money, Jay. I'm not saying just go hog wild, but I'm saying don't save money there because you'll regret it. You get a credit card breach like this, and now some of these credit card companies, especially if they can prove that it's a POS breach on your side, you're in trouble.
You're on the hook for
you're
it.
You're on the hook for this stuff now, and it's different than it used to be. And some of this stuff is very, very expensive. Your ISPs will shut you off if some kind of a malware that does transactional data or overwhelming systems of data, kind of a DOS attack, things are, you know, you start getting that. Now ISPs are starting to cut people off, and you just cannot stand that kind of trouble for your business. It'll cost you more money than it will save you by not getting a security person for sure. All right, anyway, enough of that. Go ahead.
We know that upstarts have to cut corners on certain things sometimes just to get operational. We're just saying, hey, this is not one of the areas that you want to do that on. You cut corner, buy used furniture or something if you know, for your office or whatever. There's lots of other places you can do it where you don't have the security threat where, hey, you might be on the hook for a bunch of money and stolen credit cards.
Yeah, and, you know, if you have phone lines instead of, you know, if you think you need 5 phone lines, start with 3. You know, I mean, there's a lot of ways to decrease costs, and I'm telling you, cutting corners is not an IT solution. It really isn't. All right, the FCC's in the news, Jay, and they're in the news for a lot of reasons regarding net neutrality. They've kind of rebooted net neutrality, and they're kind of at 2.0 plus, et cetera. And I'm usually quite critical of the FCC for a lot of reasons. But the FCC now considers improving its definition of broadband. Did you know that the FCC kind of decides what's broadband and what's not?
Yes, sir. The government makes the call on anything, right? We had this discussion in my family about tomatoes, whether they were a fruit or a vegetable. And the final word came down that, well, back in like 1900 something or whether, the FDA concluded that tomatoes were actually vegetables. So that's the final word. So I'm just saying, Sam, you know, you got to look to the government to know if you want the final answer on anything.
Yeah, and
so
the most FCC's people just thought broadband was anything that's not just like a dial-up phone line. It's got to be broadband because it's a little bit faster and it's broadband. Well, that is not really the case if you look at the
like
FCC's
ISDN
definition. Well, would you call ISDN broadband?
10 years ago, I would have, not today.
Okay, and that's the point that the FCC is making, too, is that what yesterday used to be broadband, now it's not. They're improving the definition of broadband to what's called a video-friendly 10 megabits per second. The FCC considers improving this. The FCC last set its definition of broadband as 4 megabits per second downstream and 1 megabit upstream, and that was fine for 2010, but you know what? 3 years or 4 years later, it's roughly outdated. You can't even deal with high HD video on that kind of a connection. So the agency is clearly aware that it needs to update their definition. So they're drafting a proposal that would increase the baseline to at least 10 megabits down and 2.9 or basically 3 megabits up. That would be broadband. Below that, not even broadband, Jay.
I agree. And, you know, what's funny is where I'm at out in the country in Florida, what I have is a 3 megabit DSL line, and now you can only get 1.5 megabits. And they are, I think, a little bit smart about it because they're not calling it broadband internet. They're calling it internet access, like it's this basic first-tier, low-level, almost what you would think of in years past of like the dial-up line. It's 1.5 megabit connection up to 1.5, and they're just calling it basic internet access.
But that's 1.5 down and about a third
of that 1.5
up,
down.
Right?
Yeah, like 256K up.
Okay, so, you know, 1.5 down, 256K up is considered the equivalent of 2014 dial-up.
Yeah. Exactly. You know what I want to know is where's WiMAX, man? Where are these wireless providers that we're just going to put up and cover whole counties and, you know, just make super fast internet? What happened to all that? It just never materialized.
I'm
going to
tell you it's a four-letter word, Jay.
C-O-S-T? Cost?
No, cost is a lot of it. Yeah, but tree is the other problem.
What, free?
No, tree. You got trees
tree,
in the way.
Tree, T-R-E-E?
Roger that.
Oh, trees.
Yeah, they're in the way.
Yeah, but I thought WiMAX was going to be like permeating like cell phone technology, you know? Cell phones don't care about trees.
There's this thing called theory and this thing called reality, Jay.
Exactly.
And I'm telling you right now that it ain't happening like they hoped. Okay, so anyway, I found that interesting, though. That the definition's changing in a 4-year period of time. Okay, it used to be 4 down, 1 up, and in 4 years, it's now 10 down, 3 up to be considered broadband. What do you think of that?
Well, they're not making this call.
4 years? No, they're opening it up for discussion.
They're considering
and all this stuff.
It. Yeah.
But I'm just saying that's their proposal. If they propose on it for a year, Jay, it'll be even behind more. But
yeah, by the time they get the standard in place, it'll be outdated. That's great work,
The question
FCC.
Is, what do you think of about a four-year span updating a definition from 4 down, 1 up to 10 down, 3 up?
Well, you can say that it's about 2.5 times, right?
Yes, sir.
More than what they had. So I think that they should just maybe they should just define their standard to some rate that they can track over time that will continue to change year by year.
Kind of like inflation or kind of like, you know, some of those things, you mean?
Sure, why not?
All right, well, it's possible.
Or if it's going to take, if it takes a year to get this ratified and actually change a definition on something, why not just, bump it up a little bit more and say this is going to be kind of future-proof for the next 5 or 10 years? We're just going to say it's like 20 megabit.
Okay, well, there you go. Now, here's the deal. Interestingly enough, I have a connection that costs me basically $150 a month, Jay. And you'd say, man, that's really expensive. That's like triple or quadruple what most families pay. You're right, but I use it for family and business. And the business that I'm in, I'm a tech guy, right? So I do radio, and it requires real-time streaming, and I do all kinds of other stuff, uploading and downloading of massive files. With video and audio, and I use it to connect to systems, and solid connections are virtually a must for me. So I kind of go overboard, but I have a business Comcast connection, cost me $150 a month, and I've got 75 megabits down and 15 megabits up. And it's fast. And once in a while it goes down, but otherwise it's great internet. And, that's what I've got. But it's expensive. $150 is a lot of money, way beyond most people's willingness to pay, that's for sure, if not even capabilities to pay. I can justify it because I say, you know what, let's just say my family pays $50 or $75. The average family might pay $50 for internet. Let's say my family pays $75 for a great connection. Who wouldn't pay a little bit more like that for a killer connection, right? And then half's my business, $75, and half's my personal. Or you could even say $100 for the business side and $50 for personal. It's justifiable for me. I've got a static IP address, that kind of stuff. And so, but it's interesting. It comes down to money, too, in my mind. In other words, if you're going to put this equation together and you're going to talk about speed, upload and download, and what it takes to do common tasks like watch video these days or whatever, you got to put a cost on it, too, Jay, because almost anybody in the country can get a pretty fast connection if they cover the cost. So you and your location could get 2 bonded T1s. You could get 3 megabit down and 3 megabit up. And you'd virtually exceed the current standards right now, at least on the upload side for sure, and get very close on the download side. The only problem is it would cost you like $800 a month, Jay.
Yeah, I was just going to say about $800 a month probably to get that done.
Or 1,000. So see, that I think that cost is the question. If we talk about broadband rollout abilities in America today, you can't just talk about speeds. You got to talk about the costs for those speeds because, it's possible to bond a lot of things together. They also have some type of Ethernet connections in your area where for $400 you can for sure exceed those speeds, right? I think about
probably.
$400 a month, yeah. But you know what? Again, what family can spend $400 a month? And what family, even if they had the money, what family should, right?
That's a new car payment.
Now you got to talk about satellite internet, too. We'll talk about that in seconds when we come back. First, Science of the Sea on Tech Watch Radio, and then Jay and me.
Protecting your liberties. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
Liberty is not free. Its costs are innumerable. Without monetary funding, the valiant efforts of freedom-loving Americans become diminished or outright defeated. We present a solution, the Give Me Liberty Fund. The plan is quite simple. Invite individual Americans to contribute less than a dollar a day. These monetary funds are used to promote liberty-minded media, organizations, events, candidates, movements, and speakers. In the spirit of transparency, all expenditures are published. patriotic business owners provide discounted products and services to Give Me Liberty Fund members. Our greatest strength is in numbers. Go to GiveMeLibertyFund.com and become part of the solution today. GiveMeLibertyFund.com. Participate in the peaceful restoration of the greatest and freest country in the world.
If you want to experience the great outdoors in comfort and style, then you need products from Teton Sports. For any of your camping, hiking, or outdoor needs, Teton Sports has top-of-the-line products for any adventure. Our sturdy and lightweight Wilderness 55 backpack has a built-in rain fly and plenty of compartments and pockets, perfect for hiking the mountains or a weekend camping trip. And our zero-degree sleeping bag features Superloft Elite 4-channel hollow fiber insulation for warmth, as well as right and left side zippers to let you zip two Teton bags together. With an adjustable mummy hood and interior storage pockets, our sleeping bags are the best on the market. Teton Sports is all you need for any outdoor adventure. Look for Teton Sports products at Amazon.com, Sportsman Warehouse, or Wholesale Sports. And next time you're preparing for an adventure, think of Teton Sports.
Yeah?
Did you want to see me, sir?
Well, I did, but now that I do, I'm not so sure.
Sir?
Johnson, I got a mission for you that could change your life.
Oh, good, sir.
It involves traveling halfway around the world without so much as half a clue of where you're going or what you're going to do when you get there.
Situation normal, sir?
Uh-huh. Right, I'll be leading this mission, Johnson, so I'll be telling you what to do.
You, sir?
That's right, Johnson, and I say first things first.
Oh, good plan, sir.
And what I say is first is food. Always remember that, Johnson. Food is a big deal.
Sir, my brother-in-law can get us a really good deal on some surplus MREs.
Johnson, if you've got half a brain and that empty head of yours, you'll call the freeze-dry guy like I did. That food is better for you, it rehydrates faster, and it's good, Johnson. And it keeps for up to 30 years.
Will we be gone that long, sir?
Well, I hope not. Now get your supplies organized and meet me down to the pier at dawn on Sunday. We sail at sunrise.
Yes, sir.
This adventure is brought to you by the freeze-dry guy. Call 866-404-3663 or visit freezedryguy.com.
You are listening to Science of the Sea on Tech Watch Radio.
Exploring Science in the Sea. Doctors tell mothers-to-be that a healthy diet helps ensure a healthy baby. That same rule applies to other creatures as well. A recent study of red drum, for example, found that spawning fish need a diet rich in fatty acids at the right time to produce healthier eggs. The findings could help operators of fish farms know just what and when to feed their brood stock. Essential fatty acids are needed for normal development and body function. An example in the human diet is omega-3 fatty acids, which are found in fish oil and other sources. Fish and their eggs need these same types of acids, but researchers have wondered just when the mother needs to stock up on them. They've also wondered whether the mother can store enough in advance to make up for a lack of them in her diet later on. Researchers at the University of Texas Marine Science Institute conducted experiments with captive red drum. They varied the levels of a fatty acid known as ARA in the diet of spawning fish. The researchers then looked at the effects those changes in diet had on the amount of ARA in the eggs. The results showed that the fatty acid in the eggs came from the mother's recent diet, the food she ate only a few days before spawning. The results suggested that fish farms can produce healthier eggs and save money by feeding a diet rich in fatty acids for only a short time. And because much of the diet fed to adult fish consists of shrimp, fish, and other seafood, it could make fish farming more environmentally sustainable. This episode of Science in the Sea was made possible by Texas Sea Grant. For the University of Texas Marine Science Institute, I'm Holly Brawley.
All right, back with you live, talking tech, as always, on your favorite talk station, Talk, at TechWatchRadio.com. If you want to get a hold of us, we'd love it. This half hour is brought to you by TetonSports.com. When you want indoor covered outdoors when you're camping, think TetonSports.com. We're talking about broadband internet, ladies and gentlemen. The FCC wants to create a new definition They want it to be super fast. Jay, I can even pay, I think it's another $100, and I can get 150 down, 20 up.
You're on it.
No, I'm not. It's not worth the difference. I can double my download speed, but I only get 25% increase to my upload speed. And I bet you that on the internet, day in and day out, you can't tell the difference between my connection and double the download speed and 25% more on the upload speed. Day to day, I don't know that you could even tell.
I'm sure that's true, because most of the servers you're connecting with aren't communicating at that speed anyway. The bottleneck no longer is at your first mile.
Right. And so, anyway, I bring that up to say that I think speeds are increasing. In fact, Comcast and some other companies are in a battle for speed dominance. And wherever Google goes, Jay, Comcast ratchets their speeds up because they got to compete with Google Fiber. And that's where the battleground is. In fact, Google and other companies now are starting to mock companies for lack of speed delivery. And it's kind of funny to watch as a lot of these companies roll out, and there's nothing but competition in my mind that's good news. Now, just so you know, you can get all over the country, Jay, great connections even with satellite. Did you know that?
Well, I know that that's the promise, but no, the delivery has
been. If you're talking about consumer grade for $50, $70, $100, it's less than stellar. Agreed. But did you know that you can literally get satellite wireless type connectivity that's business grade that's incredible?
No, and I don't believe it either.
It takes an FCC path license to get, and it's good.
Okay, and so you're putting in like an uplink downlink, right?
Yes, the problem, but a data is, one.
No, I understand. The problem with satellite is the latency, and there's no way to get around that.
Yeah, but hold on, and this is the point that I'm bringing up. The speed definition has nothing to do with latency, Jay.
I know, and that's misleading because
that's why
somehow,
I'm bringing this up.
Because, sure, you might be able to get 100 gigabit throughput, but if every time you make a request to a server, you have to wait 2 seconds before you get your response back, it doesn't matter. I mean, that's great if you're uploading or downloading big files, you're running an FTP server or some, you know, data cluster somewhere where people just need large amounts of data.
In other words, but a non-real-time reality, then it's okay. In real-time realities for phones, for all kinds of
even for watching TV, for video, you know, you're downloading, you got enough time to buffer, it works great, fine. But if you're doing, like you said, a video call, Skype, gaming, anything that requires even just regular web browsing, you know, you click on something, you want it to happen. Yeah, that's a big one, because you can't have a 2 second delay between every time you click or move your mouse. So it's just, you know, I don't think satellite is a viable option except for some very limited things. Like if you want television, you know, satellite is a great delivery method for something like that, because you can buffer it and because it's just a big fat stream. But for interactive stuff, it just doesn't work.
You got that right. Anyway, that's the claim. That's the battle. And really what it's going to mean is there's a gargantuan push to create real broadband or real delivery-capable internet to the masses. In a big cities, it's no problem. In places that are quite connected, it's no problem. But in a significant portion of America, and I'd say 40 to 50%, the options aren't that great, Jay. They're just not. America's fallen way behind when it comes to connectivity.
Well, and the problem is geographic diversity. We have, you know, you take a country like Korea or something like that, or Vietnam, it's very easy to put up something, you know, a couple of towers and cover that area really well. Japan, things like these small, dense islands. America, especially in the heartland and rural areas, there's just miles and miles of area where there isn't anything, and it's hard to cover the huge, vast expanse that is the continental United States with really good coverage. Now, for some more denser areas like cities and stuff, there's kind of ideas for a satellite option of something that would be solar powered and would just kind of buzz around in the sky and be completely aloft all the time. And it would be like a satellite, but without that huge long distance of 22,000 miles for geosynchronous orbit. So you don't have the delay. And so it could, you know, act as a relay and give people some real wireless.
In other words, think of it as a drone floating Wi-Fi hotspot city plus one.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, there's some ideas for stuff like that, but they're still, you know, pretty prototype-ish, or, you know, even on the drawing board, a lot of them. So we maybe see some better options. But for me, satellite for the average consumer internet just isn't happening. I guess it's better than nothing if, you know, you live in a cabin in Montana somewhere or whatever. Better than nothing, but it ain't good. It's kind of like still in the dial-up age as far as the, you know, latency and real world getting stuff done.
The best internet, if you can't really get some kind of a landline, meaning cable or DSL or something else, the best internet you can get in most cases, believe it or not, is 3G, 4G through your cell provider, and it's as good as it gets, whatever it is.
Yep.
Now, I know that's that right. They throttle your data, and I know that they have all kinds of issues with all that kind of stuff, but I'm just telling you, connectivity-wise, latency-wise, speed-wise, cost-wise, all put together, the best that you're going to get out in the hinterlands or out in the country somewhere is going to be whatever 3G, 4G they deliver to you based on, you know, whatever wireless carrier is strongest in your given area. It might be Verizon, might be AT&T, whatever it is, and that's the best it's going to get in terms of ubiquitous, portable, or mobile-type internet. Even a lot of places where people have a home, you would say, well, a fixed connection would be better. They can't get them. You know, you're talking about T1s for $400-$500 kind of stuff. It's just not doable for most people. You're better off getting, you know, two or three or four phones, even getting a phone on AT&T and a phone on Verizon. At least you've got now two providers. There's also technology that lets you bond internet connections together. There's devices now. One of the solutions is called ViprNet, I think is how you pronounce it. NetMondi is the company that produces it, Jay. You can buy a little box, but again, this is expensive, though. You're talking about $2,000 for the box. But the point is you can put all these cards in it, and you can literally have a DSL, a cable, a 3G, a 4G. You can have five or six different providers on different technologies. And believe it or not, it bonds them all together, and it gives you the best connectivity options over all those connections that you can get at any given time, adjustable on the fly.
It'd be interesting.
And the reason that's cool is because then nothing really goes down unless all of them go down. And yeah. You're now always taking advantage of whatever the fastest delivery options can be. There's a lot of that kind of stuff going on. Bonding of connections, load balancing of connections, and it all happens in the hardware and stuff like that on the fly, to where the average Joe just doesn't know. Once it's hooked up, it just happens. And it might not be the best option for you at your house, but a lot of businesses are starting to use this too, especially data mission critical type businesses.
Yeah. What would be cool is, you know, say if you have a solution like 3G cellular, but you get a data cap of 5 gigs, but you've got a satellite, you know, broadband connection to, if it's smart enough to say, hey, when I'm downloading something, just pop that stream over to the satellite, let it download. But if I'm, for example, remote controlling a computer, do that over the 3G connection when I need very low latency.
Now you're talking about smart routers based on protocol and based on service and needs and the likely use of that service. And hey, if I'm watching a video, I don't care if it's a 3-second buffer. Once it gets rolling on the satellite, it's great. When I want to remote control a computer, I want to have a real-time Skype kind of a voice call or whatever, then, hey, pop that over the fastest one. Anyway, all I'm telling you is there's a lot of connectivity options, and there's a lot of people working on this. And I expect the internet war to heat up in terms of connectivity. And I think that there's going to be some initiatives and some challenges and some options to really speed up America's internet. And I think broadband...
It's all about bandwidth.
Broadband defined... as 4 down, 1 up, even that's the quote. Well, I guess it would be 10 down, 3 up would be the most modern definition they're contemplating. I think that's going to be so antiquated in a few years for most of us that it'll be laughable.
I think that's very true, especially with the advent of 4K HD, which is like the next generation of high-definition video. You can't even run that on a 10K down connection, a 10 meg down connection. But, you know, with this, FCC wants to define speed as an up and down ratio. I think that the speed, when you're talking about speed of connection, you need to have a latency number in there, too. And companies that are selling internet access, they need to have an up speed, a down speed, and a latency number in there. Kind of this is their promised rate, and not too up to, you know, in some imagined world you might be able to get this. But, hey, this is what we guarantee, and you could get better. you know, but you're generally 99% of the time you're not going to get worse. You know, we know that there's bottlenecks and maybe a router goes down and things have to shift over to some secondary connection or something. But kind of a guarantee, this is what you're going to get, up, down, and latency. So people can get their arms around it and measure it a little better.
And then it costs, though, so people can put kind of a reality of what's affordable. Like I told you, I can get you pretty dang good internet if you're willing to spend the right kind of money almost anywhere in the country.
Right.
But
well,
again,
we know that when somebody's advertising – when somebody's advertising their broadband connection, cost is going to be the number one thing people are going to look at probably anyway. So that's that number is going to be in there. But it reminds me of like miles per gallon, right? The you know the Federal Transportation Commission or whatever said, hey, you need to publish for new cars the MPG. And they said, well, it's kind of complicated because if you're all in the city, it's one thing. But if you're out in the open roads, it's another thing. So they came out with, well, this is, you know, highway and this is city miles per gallon. And I think they can do that with, and still keep it simple enough that the average consumer can go, okay, up, down, and the latency and the cost, perfect. I got my arms around that one.
Well, and then you kind of start to say who's driving, because if you punch it, it's way out of whack. If you're driving, you... what is it, less than 3,000 RPMs or whatever, you know, you watch your kind of number, you know, you can really save a lot of gas if you're gentle, Jay.
That's very true. Yep. Yeah, but who'll need that when Google starts chauffeuring us all around anyway?
Yeah, good point. By the way, researchers now are claiming that camera phones are a problem, Jay. And they say that camera phones are ruining the
security
making
issue
of memories. Nope, not security this time. They're ruining the making of memories. And believe it or not, I believe what they're saying to be true. The idea is you're giving away the moment by trying to record it. And the idea here is this. We're all about to, you know, somebody's about to, you know, they come out of being married or whatever, and they give each other a kiss, and there's a photo. Or, you know, two people are celebrating a graduation, so somebody runs up and gives somebody a hug. And whatever the case may be, somebody comes off an airplane and everybody's happy to greet that person. But what happens is people are so dedicated to documenting that, so dedicated to getting the, quote, perfect photo for Instagram or whatever, to where it ruins the moment, Jay. It's like, hold on, we're super excited to see each other, but because mom has to get out the camera, you two have to stand over here. Hey, you quit laughing. You quit crying. You know what? Clean it. Your makeup's going to drip. You step back here. Hey, you know what? You need to move your hand. All right, now, look, straighten your shirt. Look, put your skirt down. And by the time you get all that done, you've ruined the moment of whatever it is, Jay.
Yeah,
now,
but you
have,
know,
a perfect photo, but now you're living for a, quote, photo op moment rather than a real life moment.
I agree, and I can see this side of it. But I would also think that the other side of this argument could be made that camera phones and the ability are actually preserving memories far better than we would have otherwise.
And there's debates on that. Till the cows come home. And I'm not really here to advocate and say that one side's right and the other side's wrong, because I believe both sides have their valid points. But I would say this, and here's the proof. I went on a trip for about 8 days. And do you realize that we have 500 photos archived in a folder from those days?
Yes, I do. I definitely think that that's probably true.
All right, now. That's 500 after somebody weeded out the ones that we just felt like were not even useful. So there was a lot more taken, probably. How many? I don't know. But we know there's about 480-some-odd pictures from those days. And we know that probably a third of them are 25, maybe 20% of them aren't really good. You might throw out some of them. You might get 300 photos for the 8 days, Jay.
Right.
Have we taken so many pictures they almost become worthless?
I think it does lower the value. I mean, imagine when in the 1800s or something, when you might have one or two photos ever taken of your entire family. You know, so those pictures would be very, very valuable, even for posterity, right? And so have we cheapened it by making more? I'm sure. I mean, supply and demand comes into effect here. But think about this. How well documented is that trip? If you ever want to go back and kind of reminisce about that trip, you've got a lot of material to go over and to, you know, share with other people or whatever. It's, like I said, it goes both ways. You could say, oh, yeah, well, having all these things kind of ruined the moment because we were so busy taking pictures we didn't really enjoy it. But I don't think that's true. It's about the experience. You were there, and now it's far better documented than you could have ever hoped to have unless you'd had Google Glass or something recording the whole trip.
And that's
but
the
even then.
That's the point that we're getting at, though. At what point is there a balance where you say, sure, we don't want to have to stand there and it takes like 5 minutes to take a picture where everybody has a grim look on their face because they're so focused on concentration like yesteryear. And they used to say, right. Why does everybody look grumpy in the old pictures? Well, dude, if you had to stand there with a fly on your head and not move for 5 minutes and it was hotter than all get out, you'd be grumpy too. You know, okay,
in your dress blacks.
Yeah, exactly. But now that, you know, you can take 3 gazillion pictures. I mean, I have people now where they've got these fast cameras and high-speed flash chips to where even when they take a picture, instead of going 3, 2, 1, now they go, all right, are you ready? One of those will work.
Exactly.
And if we gone overboard, and then if we go to Google Glass and do full video, at what point does it become disturbing to the real experience, to so-called preserved memories? And is there a balance there that makes sense? Is the reason that I bring it up, and I think that there's a valid question here about it. I'm for
videos. Well, just imagine.
And I'm for, you know, I'm not against cameras and pictures, and I'm not against documenting an event. But when does it become disruptive to the actual memory of the event? When does it kind of ruin the moment, et cetera? And
well, just
I'm
imagine
not saying there's a
taken...
fine line that you can define. I think it's different for everybody, but it is something to be considered.
Right. If you'd have taken video for that whole event, 8 days, 192 hours of video, you had recorded, just imagine how much more worthless a lot of that video would have been compared to just 480 or 300 select pictures of some of the best things. So I certainly think that weeding it down to the best is great. And I'm one of those people that have said, especially in the dawn of digital photography, hey man, this isn't film. It doesn't cost anything to take a few extra pictures. Snap 2 or 3 or 4 instead. But now that pictures are so big, you know, a picture is like a meg or more, or 2 or 3 or 4. It's like, you know, just take 1 or 2 and just take the best shots. I'm actually kind of coming back to like the film where it's like, I'm just going to take the best 1 or 2 pictures because I have so many pictures that it's
I
like,
agree.
I don't want 15
and
of the one
post.
And
your point is well taken, and we got to kind of weed that out. The reason for the 15 for the one post is to really get the best 2 or 3. The problem is then do you really take the time to get rid of the ones you don't need? Or
exactly.
Are you like, oh, I better just save all these because...
If you're not going to take the time to go back and weed those out, you're better off having one where, oh, Johnny had his eyes closed on this one, but so what? I got this picture rather than 15 of them that I never went back and weeded out.
That's right. And then you're always debating which one's the best one all the time and how much time is wasted on that. Now, here's the next issue. I think that a wedding is probably one of the most important things in someone's life. Would you agree with that, Jay?
I would say it's a very big milestone. Probably
one of the most. Sure. I don't know if it's the most, but it's one of them without question. All right. On my wedding, we had a guy taking video, and we actually watched these videos. But what happened is this guy, he focused on the piano player too much. And so there's literally, I don't know, 2-3 minutes at a time in this big, nice video where he's just kind of photoing the piano player, and it's kind of boring.
The piano player was his wife, probably.
No, it was just this lady. And, you know, he was focusing on it because you could hear the music in the background, and it made sense for transitions, but he took too long doing it. And so now the big joke among my kids who watch our wedding video, they've determined that whenever the camera goes to the piano player, it's like FF.
Oh, fast forward, right?
Yeah. And so now what you got is this awesome wedding video with too much coverage in it where FF is the mantra for memories.
You know what the latest thing in wedding videos now is not just to shoot it with one camera somewhere. It's to shoot it with multiple cameras and then post-produce it down to like a 3 to 5 minute video that's got behind the scenes before the wedding and the girls' room and the groom's rooms and the wedding
and
itself and all
right,
the highlights.
You can take a whole day and make it a 45-minute video, and it's incredible if you pan back and
forth. No, 45 minutes is way too long, Sam. That's way too last century. It's got to be like YouTube. It's got to be 3 to 5 minutes of all the best from the video, and that's it. That's all the attention span that somebody's going to give to watching your video, and it better be all the best stuff, and it better be humorous and entertaining and not just like some drab camera rolling from one position sort of thing. That's the latest in wedding videos, man.
Well, and that brings up the
exact... And it's going to cost you like $2,000 to get that done, at least.
And that brings up the exact point that I'm making, whether you do the slow video my style where, it, you know, hey, he edited it down some, but it was literally fast forward a lot of it because it was boring. And to the ultra extreme the other way, it would be like, hey, it's got to be 5 minutes. It's got to be packed with everything incredible, and the transitions have to be awesome, and it's got to be highly produced, professional, post-edited stuff.
Yes, sir. You got to sit on the edge of your seat.
And if that's all true, then these 400 pitchers we've got, probably you only need about 150 of them.
Yeah, man, you got to have that. You got to take that thing and put it to a fast-paced set of music, and you know, no more than like 1.5 seconds per slide, and down to the 150 best, and make that thing happen in just a, you know, 2-minute slideshow with some rocking music in the background.
And then I got a question: is it better if I just watch that blast through turbo, unrealistic, high-speed memories of modern day, or is it better for me just to have maybe 10 pitchers and me to remember the event?
Oh, you need the high-speed, fast-action slideshow music.
I think if I sit back and have 10, 20, 30 pictures and I actually remember the event as it really occurred without being interrupted by all these cameras and videos and all this stuff, at some point you get a fast-forward slash high-speed warped view of an event, too. Everything in life doesn't happen in 5 minutes. Everything doesn't happen in terms of resolving crime in 30 minutes, as they used to say on TV. Life isn't that way, and a little bit of slowdown, a little... Cherry Coke Mayberry might be the answer, Jay.
Oh, Sam, you're just getting old. Come on.
I guess I am. But
you're not hip with it.
I'm telling you that I believe there's a balance there that I believe has validity to it and actually matters.
You can't remember it, though. You can't remember it accurately.
So I want a 10, 20, 30, 40 photo reminder of some of it. But I want to rely more on my memories based on a few prompts. Maybe a journal with a few words or a few little write-ups about it and a few pictures. I want that to preserve memories. But when you start to make it to where it's so highly produced, Sam, we took 15,000 pictures. We narrowed it down to the best 1,000, and then we basically touched up the 500 that made sense, and then we put this, you know, turbo video together for you that's like 4 minutes in length or 7 minutes in length, and now you're going to watch this put to music in this high speed. It's like everything in life, I've lived days in minutes. And at some point, you distort memories out of their original, in my opinion, focus. Instead of looking back at your wedding going, man, that was nice, I sure. You're going, wow, that was a whirlwind of craziness. Thank the good heavens that's over. And I don't
then
know.
Then you flop down exhausted after you watch that.
Yeah, and then I'm not so sure we preserve memories. In fact, we perverted memories. And that's the whole point of that little piece there. When are you ruining the moment? When does it make the most sense? How do you best preserve memories? Does a balance make sense? And I think that's what we'll come back to. And that's why folks like to take photos and make them black and white for those very preserving of memories reasons. Not only that, they kind of look cool. All right, thanks so much. That's a wrap, ladies and gentlemen. Sam and Jay talking tech. Hopefully it was educational and interesting. Please tell your favorite radio station to carry the broadcast. You want to learn more? TechWatchRadio.com. You want to email us? Talk@TechWatchRadio.com. For Sam and Jay and the TechWatch Radio team, make it a great tech day, will you? Hey, thanks.